Chapter 30. Fever Years. November 1857 to April 1870. Both of them were true to their word. Abner Marsh kept on looking, but he did not find her. They left Aaron Gray's plantation as soon as Carl Fram was strong enough to travel, several days after Joshua York had vanished. Marsh was glad to be gone. Gray and his kin were getting mighty curious by then about why there was nothing in the papers about a steamboat explosion, and why none of their neighbours had heard of it, and why Joshua had taken off. And Marsh was getting tangled up in his own lies. By the time he and Toby and Carl Fram got themselves upriver, the fever dream was gone as he'd known she would be. Marsh returned to St. Louis. Through the long, dreary winter, Marsh kept up his search. He wrote more letters, he loitered around the riverfront bars and billiard halls. He hired some more detectives, he read too damn many newspapers. He found Yerger and Grove and the rest of the crew of the Eli Reynolds and sent them up and down the river, cabin passage, looking. All of it turned up nothing. No one had seen the fever dream. No one had seen the Ozymandias either. Abner Marsh figured they'd changed the name again. He'd read every goddamn poem Byron and Shelley ever wrote, but this time it was no use. It got so bad he had the damn poems memorized, and he even went on to other poets. But the only thing he found that way was a sorry-looking Missouri sternwheeler named the Hiawatha. Marsh did get one report from his detectives, but it told him nothing he hadn't figured out already. The sidewheel steamer Ozymandias had left Natchez that October night with about 400 tons of freight, 40 cabin passengers, and maybe twice as many deckers. The freight had never been delivered. Neither the steamer nor the passengers had ever been seen again, except at a few woodyards just downstream of Natchez. Abner Marsh read over that letter half a dozen times, frowning. The numbers were way too low, which meant that Sour Billy was doing one damn poor job, unless he'd kept them down deliberate, so Julian and his night folks could have an easy time of it. 120 people were gone, vanished. It gave Marsh a cold sweat. He stared at that letter and remembered what Damon Julian had said to him. "No one on the river will ever forget your fever dream." For months, Abner Marsh was plagued by terrible nightmares of a boat moving down the river, all black, every lamp and candle extinguished, the big black tarpaulins hung all around the main deck so even the ruddy light of the furnaces could not escape. A boat dark as death and black as sin, a shadow moving through moonlight and fog, hardly seen, quiet and fast. In his dreams she made no sound as she moved, and white shapes flitted about her deck silently and haunted her grand saloon, and inside their staterooms the passengers huddled in fear, until the doors opened one midnight, and then they began to scream. Once or twice Marsh woke up screaming as well, and even in his waking hours he could not forget her, his dream boat cloaked in shadows and screams, with smoke as black as Julian's eyes and steam the colour of blood. By the time the ice was breaking up on the upper river, Abner Marsh was faced with a hard choice. He had not found the fever dream, and the search had brought him to the brink of ruin. His ledger books told a grim story. His coffers were almost empty. He owned a steamboat company without any steamboats, and he lacked even the funds to have a modest one built. So, reluctantly, Marsh wrote his agents and detectives and called off the hunt. With the little money he had left, he went downriver, to where the Eli Reynolds still sat in the cut-off that had wrecked her. They fitted a new rudder to her and patched up her sternwheel a little and waited for the spring floods. The floods came, the cut-off became passable once more, and Yerger and his crew nursed the Reynolds back up to St. Louis, where she was fitted with a brand new paddle, a new engine with twice the push, and a second boiler. She even got a new paint job and a bright yellow carpet for her main cabin. Then Marsh launched her into the New Orleans trade, for which she was too small and too shabby and altogether poorly fitted, so he could continue his hunt personally. Abner Marsh knew even before he started that it was near hopeless. Between Cairo and New Orleans alone there was some 1,100 miles of river. Then there was the upper Mississippi, above Cairo, all the way to the Falls of St. Anthony. There was the Missouri. There was the Ohio and the Yazoo and the Red River and about 50 other secondary rivers and tributaries navigable by steamer, most of which had tributaries of their own, not to mention all the little creeks and streams and cut-offs that were navigable part of the year, if you had a good pilot. She could be hiding up any one of them, and if the Eli Reynolds steamed past and missed her, it would mean starting all over again. Thousands of steamboats plied the Mississippi River system, with newcomers entering the trade every month, which meant lots of damned names to sort through in the papers. But Marsh was nothing if not stubborn. He searched, and the Eli Reynolds became his home. She did not get much trade. The biggest, fastest, most luxurious steamboats on the river competed in the St. Louis to New Orleans run, and the Reynolds, old and slow as she was, attracted little custom away from the great side-wheelers. "It's not just that she's fast as a snail and twice as ugly," Marsh's New Orleans agent told him in the fall of 1858 while giving notice to take another job. "It's you, too, damned if I ain't telling the truth." "Me?" Marsh roared. "What the hell you mean?" "Folks on the river talk, you know. They say you're the unluckiest man ever to own a steamboat. They say you got some kind of curse on you, worse than the curse on the Drennan White. One of your steamers blew her boilers, they say, and killed everybody. Four got crushed up in an ice jam. One got burned after everybody on her died of yaller fever. And the last one, they say you wrecked her yourself after you went crazy and beat your pilot with a club." "Damn that man," Marsh swore. "Now I ask you, who the hell is going to ride with a cursed man like that? Or work for him either? Not me, I tell you that for sure. Not me." The man he'd hired to replace Jonathan Jeffers begged Marsh more than once to take the Reynolds out of the New Orleans trade and have her work the upper Mississippi or the Illinois, where she'd be better suited, or even the Missouri, which was rough and dangerous, but enormously profitable if your steamboat didn't get smashed to splinters. Abner Marsh refused and fired the man when he persisted. He figured there was no chance that he'd find the fever dream on the northern rivers. Besides, during the last few months he'd been making secret stops by night at certain Louisiana woodyards and deserted islands in Mississippi and Arkansas, taking on runaway slaves and bringing them up north to the free states. Toby had put him in touch with a bunch called the Underground Railroad, who made all the arrangements. Abner Marsh had no use for the goddamn railroads and insisted on calling it the Underground River, but it made him feel good to help, kind of like he was hurting Damon Julian somehow. At times he'd hunker down with the runaways on the main deck and ask them about night folks and the fever dream and such, figuring that maybe the blacks knew things that white folks didn't. But none of them ever told him anything useful. For nearly 3 years, Abner Marsh continued his hunt. There were hard years. By 1860, Marsh was heavily in debt due to the losses incurred in running the Reynolds. He had been forced to close the offices he had maintained in St. Louis, New Orleans, and other river towns. Nightmares no longer troubled him as they had, but he grew more and more isolated with the passage of years. At times it seemed to Marsh as if the time he had spent with Joshua York on the fever dream was the last real life he had known, that the months and years since then were drifting past as if in a dream. At other times he felt just the opposite, felt that this was real, the red ink in his ledger books, the deck of the Eli Reynolds under him, the smell of her steam, the stains on her new yellow carpet. The memories of Joshua, the splendour of the great steamboat they had built together, the cold terror that Julian had stirred in him, these things were the dream, Marsh thought, and no wonder they had vanished, no wonder that folks along the river thought him mad. The events of the summer of 1857 became even more dreamlike as, one by one, those who had shared some of Marsh's experiences began to drift out of his life. Old Toby Lanyard had gone east a month after they had returned to St. Louis. Being returned to slavery once had been enough for him. Now he wanted to get as far from the slave states as possible. Marsh got a brief letter from him early in 1858, saying that he'd gotten a job cooking in a Boston hotel. After that, he never heard from Toby again. Dan Albright had found himself a berth on the spanking new Orleans sidewheeler. In the summer of 1858, however, Albright and his boat had the misfortune to be in New Orleans during a virulent outbreak of yellow fever. It killed thousands, including Albright, and eventually led to the city improving its sanitation, so it wasn't quite so much like an open sewer in the summer. Captain Yerger ran the Eli Reynolds for Marsh until after the season of 1859, when he retired to his farm in Wisconsin, where he died peacefully a year later. When Yerger had gone, Marsh took over captaining the stern wheeler himself to save money. By then, only a handful of familiar faces remained among the crew. Doc Turney had been killed and robbed in Natchez under the hill the previous summer, and Cat Grove had left the river entirely to go west, first to Denver then to San Francisco, and eventually all the way to China or Japan or some such godforsaken place. Marsh hired Jack Eli, the old second engineer from the Fever Dream, to replace Turney, and took on a few of the other crewmen who'd served on the vanished sidewheeler as well. But they died or drifted on or took other jobs. By 1860, only Marsh himself and Carl Fram were left of all those who had lived through the triumph and terror of 1857. Fram piloted the Reynolds, for all that his skills entitled him to a much bigger and more prestigious boat. Fram remembered a whole lot of things he wouldn't talk about, even to Marsh. The pilot was still good-natured, but he didn't tell near so many stories as he used to, and Marsh could see a grimness in his eyes that hadn't been there before. Fram wore a pistol now. "In case we find them," he said. Marsh snorted. "That little thing ain't going to hurt Julian none." Carl Fram's grin was still crooked, and his gold tooth caught the light, but there was nothing funny in his eyes when he answered. "Ain't for Julian, Cap'n. It's for me. They ain't getting me alive again." He looked at Marsh. "I could do the same for you if it comes to that." Marsh scowled. "It ain't coming to that," he said, and he left the pilot house. He remembered that conversation for the rest of his days. He also remembered a Christmas party in St. Louis in 1859, given by the captain of one of the big Ohio boats. Marsh and Fram both attended, along with every other steamboatman in the town, and after everybody had been drinking some, they got to telling river stories. He knew all the stories, but it was kind of peaceful and reassuring somehow to hear folks telling them all over again to the traders and bankers and pretty women who hadn't ever heard none of them. They talked about Old Al, the Alligator King, about the Phantom Steamer of Recursey, about Mike Fink and Jim Bowie and Roaring Jack Russell, about the great race between the Eclipse and the A.L. Shotwell, about the pilot who'd run a nasty stretch of river in the fog even though he'd gone and died, about the goddamn steamboat that had brought smallpox up the river 20 years before and killed something like 20,000 Indians. "Ruined the hell out of the fur trade," the storyteller concluded, and everybody laughed, except Marsh and a couple of others. Then someone went through the brags about the impossibly big steamers, the Hurricano and the E. Jenkins and such, that grew their own wood with forests on their hurricane decks and had wheels so big they took a whole year to make a full turn. Abner Marsh smiled. Carl Fram pushed through the crowd, a brandy in his hand. "I know a story," he said, sounding a little drunk. "It's true. There's this steamboat named the Ozymandias, you see?" "Never heard of it," somebody said. Fram smiled thinly. "You better hope you never see it," he said, "'cause them what does is done for. She only runs by night, this boat, and she's dark, all dark, painted black as her stacks, every inch of her, except that inside she's got a main cabin with a carpet the colour of blood and silver mirrors everywhere that don't reflect nothing. Them mirrors is always empty, even though she's got lots of folks aboard her, pale-looking folks in fine clothes. They smile a lot, only they don't show in the mirrors." Someone shivered. They had all gone silent. "Why not?" asked an engineer Marsh knew slightly. "'Cause they're dead," Fram said. "Every damn one of 'em dead. Only they won't lie down. They're sinners, and they got to ride that boat forever, that black boat with the red carpets and the empty mirrors, all up and down the river and never touching port, no sir."
"Phantoms," somebody said.
"Haunts?" added a woman. "Like that Recursey boat?"
"Hell no," said Carl Fram. "You can pass right through a haunt, but not the Ozymandias. She's real enough, and you'll learn it quick into your sorrow if you come on her at night. Them dead folks is hungry. They drink blood, you know, hot red blood. They hide in the dark, and when they see the lights of another steamer, they set out after her. And if they catch her, they come swarming aboard, all those dead white faces, smiling, dressed so fine. And they sink the boat afterward, or burn her, and the next morning there's nothing to see but a couple stacks sticking up out the river, or maybe a wrecked boat full of corpses. Except for the sinners. The sinners go aboard that Ozymandias and ride on her forever."
He sipped his brandy and smiled.
"So if you're out on the river some night and you see a shadow on the water behind you, look close. It might be a steamer painted black all over with a crew as white as haunts. She don't show no lights, that Ozymandias, so sometimes you can't see her till she's right behind you. her black wheels kicking up the water. If you see her, you better hope you got a lightning pilot and maybe some coal oil on board or a little lard, because she's big and she's fast, and when she catches you by night, you're finished. Listen for her whistle. She only sounds her whistle when she knows she's got you, so if you hear it, start counting up your sins.
What's the whistle sound like?
Exactly like a man screaming, said Carl Fram.
What's her name again? A young pilot asked.
Ozymandias, said Fram.
He knew how to say it right.
What does that mean?
Abner Marsh stood up.
It's from a poem, he said. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair.
The party crowd looked at him blankly, and one fat lady laughed a nervous, tittering sort of laugh.
There are curses and worse things on that old Devil River, a short clerk started in.
While he was talking, Marsh took Carl Fram by the arm and drew him outside.
Why the hell do you tell that story? Marsh demanded.
To make them afraid, said Fram. So if they see her, some damned night they'll have the sense to run.
Abner Marsh considered that, and finally gave a reluctant nod.
I suppose it's all right. You called her by Sour Billy's name. If you'd said fever dream, Mr. Fram, I'd have twisted your goddamned head off right then and there. You hear me?
Fram heard, but it didn't matter. The story was out for good or for ill. Marsh heard a garbled version of it from another man's lips a month later, while he was dining in the planter's house, and twice more that winter. The story got changed some in the telling, of course, even to the name of the black steamboat. Ozymandias was too strange and too hard for most of the tellers, it seemed. But no matter what they named the boat, it was the same damned story. A little over half a year later, Marsh heard another story, one that changed his life. He had just sat down to dinner in a small St. Louis hotel, cheaper than the planter's house and the Southern, but with good food. It was less popular with rivermen as well, which suited Marsh fine. His old friends and rivals looked at him queer in recent years, or avoided him as unlucky, or just wanted to sit down and talk about his misfortunes, and Marsh had no patience with any of that. He preferred to be left alone. That day in 1860, he was sitting there peacefully, drinking a glass of wine and waiting for the waiter to fetch out the roasted duck and yams and snap beans and hot bread he'd ordered, when he got interrupted.
"Ain't seen you in a year," the man said.
Marsh recognized him vaguely. The man had been a striker on the A.L. Shotwell a few years back. Grudgingly, he invited him to sit.
"Don't mind if I do," the ex-striker said, and immediately pulled out a chair and commenced the gabbing.
He was a second engineer on some New Orleans boat Marsh had never heard of, and full of gossip and river news. Marsh listened politely, wondering when his food would show up. He hadn't eaten all day. The duck had just arrived, and Marsh was spreading butter over a chunk of good hot bread when the engineer said,
"Say, you heard about that windstorm down to New Orleans?"
Marsh chewed on his bread, swallowed, took another bite.
"No," he said, not very interested.
Isolated as he'd been, he didn't hear much talk of floods and windstorms and other like calamities. The man whistled through a gap in his yellow teeth.
"Hell, it was a bad one. A bunch of boats tore loose and got busted up good. Eclipse was one of them. Smashed her up pretty bad, I hear."
Marsh swallowed his bread and put down the knife and fork he'd lifted to attack the duck.
"The Eclipse?" he said.
"Yes, sir."
"How bad?" Marsh asked. "Cap'n Sturgeon will fix her up, won't he?"
"Hell, she's too busted up for that," the engineer said. "I heard they'll use what's left as a wharf boat up to Memphis."
"A wharf boat?"
Marsh repeated numbly, thinking of those tired old grey hulls that lined the landings in St. Louis and New Orleans and the other big river towns. Boats gutted of engines and boilers, empty shells used only for stowing and transferring freight.
"She ain't. She's me, I figure that's about what she deserves," the man said. "Hell, we would have beaten her with the Shotwell, only—"
Marsh made a strangled, growling sound deep in his throat.
"Get the hell out of here," he roared. "If you weren't a Shotwell man, I'd kick your goddamned ass out in the street for what you just said. Now get out of here."
The engineer got up real quickly.
"You're crazy as they say," he blurted before he left.
Abner Marsh sat at that table for the longest time, his food untouched in front of him, staring off at nothing, a grim cold look settling over his face. Finally a waiter approached timidly.
Is something wrong with your duck, Captain?
Marsh looked down. The duck had gotten a little cold. Grease was starting to congeal around it.
I ain't hungry no more, he said.
He pushed away the plate, paid his bill and left. He spent the following week going over his ledger books, adding up his debts. Then he called in Carl Fram.
It ain't no goddamn use, Marsh said to him. She'll never run against the Eclipse now, even if we find her, which we won't. I'm tired of looking. I'm taking the Reynolds into the Missouri trade, Carl. I gotta make some money.
Fram stared at him accusingly.
I'm not licensed for the Missouri. I know. I'm letting you go. You deserve a better boat than the Reynolds anyway.
Carl Fram sucked on his pipe and said nothing. Marsh could not look him in the eye. He shuffled some papers.
I'll pay you all the wages, do you? He said.
Fram nodded and turned to go. At the door he stopped.
If I get a berth, he said, I'll keep looking. If I find her, you'll hear. You won't find her, Marsh said bluntly.
Then Fram closed the door and walked off his steamer and out of his life, and Abner Marsh was as alone as he had ever been. Now there was nobody left but him, nobody who remembered the fevered dream or Joshua's white suit or the hell that beckoned behind Damon Julian's eyes. Now it only lived because Marsh remembered, and Marsh was aiming to forget. The years passed. The Eli Reynolds made money in the Missouri trade. For almost a year she ran there, and Marsh captained her and sweated with her and tended to his freight and his passengers and his ledger books. He made enough in his first two trips to pay off three-quarters of his considerable debts. He might have grown rich had not events in the larger world conspired against him. Lincoln's election, Marsh voted for him, despite the fact that he was a Republican. The secession, the firing on Fort Sumter. Marsh thought of Joshua York's words as the carnage approached. The red thirst is on this nation, and only blood will sate it. It took a great deal of blood, Marsh reflected afterward, bitterly. He seldom spoke about the war or his experiences in it, and had little patience with those who fought the battles over and over again.
There was a war, he would say loudly. We won. Now it's done with, and I don't see why we got to yammer about it endlessly like it was something to be proud of. Only good thing come out of it was ending slavery. The rest I got no use for. Shooting a man ain't nothing to build a brag on, goddammit.
Marsh and the Eli Reynolds returned to the upper Mississippi during the early years of the fighting, bringing troops down from St. Paul and Wisconsin and Iowa. Later on he served on a Union gunboat and saw action in a couple of river battles. Carl Fram fought on the river too. Marsh heard that he died in the fighting at Vicksburg, but he never knew for sure. When peace came, Marsh returned to St. Louis and took the Eli Reynolds into the upper Mississippi trade. He formed a brief association with the owner-captains of four rival boats, setting up a packet line with regular schedules to compete more effectively with the larger companies that ruled the upper river. But they were all strong-willed, stubborn men, and after a half-year of quarrels and bluster, the company was dissolved. By that time, Abner Marsh found he had no appetite for the steamboat business anymore. The river had changed somehow. After the war, there didn't seem to be a third as many steamers as there had been before it, yet the competition was fiercer since the railroads were taking up more and more of the trade. Now, when you steamed into St. Louis, you found maybe a dozen steamers along the levee, where once they had been crammed in for more than a mile. There were other changes as well in those years following the war. Coal began to crowd out wood just about everywhere, except on the wilder reaches of the Missouri. Federal regulators moved in with rules and laws that had to be followed, safety checks and registers and all manner of stuff, and even tried to prohibit racing. The steamboatmen changed too. Most of the men Marsh had known were dead or retired now, and those who took their places were strangers with strange ways. The old, boisterous, cussing, free-spending Wild River man who slapped you on the back, bought you drinks all night and told you outrageous lies was a dying breed now. Even Natchez under the hill was only a ghost of its former self, Marsh heard. Nearly as sedate as the city on the top of the hill, with all its proper mansions with their fancy names. One night in May of 1868, more than 10 years after he had last seen Joshua York and the fevered dream, Abner Marsh took a walk along the levee. He thought back on the night when he and Joshua had first met, and walked along this same landing. The steamers had been crowded in then, great, proud, big side-wheelers and tough little stern-wheelers, old boats and new ones, and the Eclipse had been there among them, tied up to her wharf-boat. Now the Eclipse had become a wharf-boat herself, and there were boys on this river who called themselves strikers and mud-clerks and cub-pilots who had never laid eyes on her. And the landing was nearly empty. Marsh stood and counted. 5 boats. 6 if you counted the Eli Reynolds. The Reynolds was so old now that Marsh was half afraid to take her out on the river. She must be the oldest damn steamboat in the world, he thought, with the oldest captain, and him and her were both just as tired. The Great Republic was taking on freight. She was a huge new side-wheeler that had come out of some Pittsburgh boatyard the year before. They said she was 335 feet long, which made her the biggest steamer on the river now that the Eclipse and the Fever Dream were both gone and forgotten. She was grand, too. Marsh had looked her over a dozen times and gone aboard her once. Her pilot house was surrounded with all kinds of fancy trim and had an ornate cupola on top of it, and the paintings and glass and polished wood and carpets inside her were enough to break your heart. She was supposed to be the finest, prettiest steamboat ever built, luxurious enough to put all the older boats to shame. But she wasn't especially fast, Marsh had heard, and she was said to be losing money at a frightening rate. He stood with his arms folded against his chest, looking gruff and stern in his severe black coat, and he watched the roustabouts load her up. The rousters were black, every man among them. That was another change. All the roustabouts on the river were blacks now. The immigrants who'd worked as rousters and stokers and deckers before the war were gone, Marsh didn't know where, and the freedmen had taken their places. As they worked, the rousters sung. Their song was a low, melancholy chant. The night is dark, the day is long, it went, and we are far from home. Weep, my brothers, weep. Marsh knew the chant. There was another verse, one that went, the night is past, the long day done, and we are going home. Shout, my brothers, shout. But they were not singing that verse. Not tonight, here on the empty steamer landing, loading up a boat that was spanking new and plush as any, but still couldn't get enough trade. Watching them, listening, it seemed to Abner Marsh as if the whole river was dying, and him with it. He had seen enough dark nights and long days for the rest of his time on earth, and he was no longer certain he even had a home. Abner Marsh walked slowly away from the landing back to his hotel. The next day he discharged his officers and crew, dissolved Fever River packets, and put the Eli Reynolds up for sale. Marsh took what money he had, left St. Louis entirely, and bought a small house in his old hometown, Galena, within sight of the river. Only it wasn't the Fever River anymore. They'd gone and changed it to the Galena River years ago, and now everyone was calling it that. The new name had better associations, folks said. Abner Marsh went calling it the Fever, like it was called when he was a boy. He didn't do much in Galena. He read a lot of newspapers. That had gotten to be a habit with him during the years he was searching for Joshua, and he liked to keep up with the fast boats and their times. Well, there were still a few of them. The Robert E. Lee had come out of New Albany in 1866 and was a real heller. The Wild Bob Lee, some rivermen called her, or just the Bad Bob. And Cap'n Tom Leathers, as tough and mean and cussed a riverman as ever captained a steamer, had launched a new Natchez in 1869, the 6th of that name. Leathers named all his steamboats Natchez. The new Natchez was faster than any of the earlier ones, according to the papers. She cut through the water like a knife, and Leathers was bragging all up and down the river how he was going to show up Cap'n John Cannon and his Wild Bob Lee. The newspapers were full of it. He could smell a race coming on, even clear up in Illinois, and it sounded like one they'd talk about for years. "I'd like to see that goddamn race," he said to the woman he'd hired to clean house for him one day. "Neither of 'em would have a chance against the Eclipse, though. You got my word on that." "Both of 'em got better times than your old Eclipse," she said. She liked to sass him, that woman. Marsh snorted. "Don't mean nothing. River's shorter now. River gets shorter every year. Pretty soon you'll be able to walk from St. Louis to New Orleans." Marsh read more than just newspapers. Thanks to Joshua, he'd worked up a taste for poetry, of all the damn things, and he looked at an occasional novel, too. He also took up wood carving, and made himself detailed models of his steamboats as he remembered them. He painted them and everything, and did them all to the same scale so you could put them alongside each other and see how big they'd been.
That was my Elizabeth A, he told his housekeeper proudly the day he finished the sixth and biggest model. As sweet a boat as ever moved down the river. She would have set records, except for that damned ice jam. You can see how big she was, near 300 feet. Look at how she dwarfs my old Nick Perrault there, he pointed. And that's the Sweet Fever and the Dunleith. Had a lot of trouble with a larboard engine on her, a lot of trouble. And next to her, that's my Mary Clark. She blew her boilers. Marsh shook his head. Killed a lot of people, too. Maybe it was my fault, I don't know. I think about it sometimes. The little one on the end is the Eli Reynolds. Not much to look at, but she was a tough old gal. She took everything I could give her and a lot more, and kept her steam up and her wheel turning. You know how long she lasted, that little ugly stern-wheeler? No, the housekeeper said. Didn't you have some other boat, too? A real fancy one, I heard. Never mind what you heard, goddammit. Yes, I had another boat. The Fever Dream, named her after the river.
The housekeeper made a rude noise at him.
No wonder this ain't never become the town it might have, with folks like you going on about the Fever River. They must think we're all sick up here. Why didn't you call it right? It's named the Galena River now.
Abner Marsh snorted. Changing the goddamn name of the goddamn river? I never heard of such goddamn foolishness. Far as I'm concerned, it's the Fever River, and it's going to stay the Fever River no matter what the hell the goddamned mayor says. He scowled. Or you neither. Hell, the way they're letting it silt up, pretty soon it's going to be the goddamned Galena Creek.
Such language. I'd think a man who reads poetry would be able to keep a civil tongue in his head.
Never mind about my goddamned tongue, Marsh said. And don't go yapping that poetry around the town neither, you hear? I knew a man who liked those poems. That's the only reason I got them books. You just stop butting your nose in and keep my steamboats clean of dust.
Certainly. Will you be making a model of that other boat, do you think? The Fever Dream?
Marsh settled into a big overstuffed chair and frowned.
No, he said. No, I ain't. That's one boat I just want to forget about. So you just get to dusting and stop pestering me with your damn fool questions.
He picked up a newspaper and began to read about the Natchez and Leather's latest boat. His housekeeper made a clucking noise and finally commenced the dusting. His house had a high round turret facing south. At evening, Marsh would often go up there with a glass of wine or a cup of coffee, sometimes a piece of pie. He didn't eat like he used to, not since the war. Food just didn't seem to taste the same. He was still a big man, but he had lost at least 100 pounds since his days with Joshua and the Fevered Dream. His flesh hung loose on him everywhere, like he'd bought it a couple of sizes too large, expecting it to shrink. He had big, droopy jowls, too.
"Makes me even uglier than I used to be," he would growl when he glanced in the mirror.
Sitting by his turret window, Marsh could see the river. He spent a lot of nights there, reading, drinking, and looking out on the water. The river was pretty in the moonlight, flowing past him, on and on, like it had flowed before he was born, like it would flow after he was dead and buried. Seeing it made Marsh feel peaceful, and he treasured that feeling. Most of the time he just felt weary or melancholy. He had read one poem by Keats that said there wasn't nothing as sad as a beautiful thing dying, and it seemed to Marsh sometimes that every goddamn beautiful thing in the world was withering away. Marsh was lonely, too. He had been on the river so many years that he had no real friends left in Galena. He never had visitors, never talked to anyone but his damned annoying housekeeper. She vexed him considerably, but Marsh didn't really mind. It was about all he had left to keep his blood hot. Sometimes he thought his life was over, and that made him so angry he turned red. He still had so many goddamned things he'd never done, so much unfinished business. But there was no denying that he was getting old. He used to carry that old hickory walking stick to gesture with and be fashionable. Now he had an expensive gold-handled cane to help him walk better. And he had wrinkles around his eyes and even between his warts, and a funny kind of brown spot on the back of his left hand. He'd look at it sometimes and wonder how it had got there. He'd never noticed. Then he would cuss and pick up a newspaper or a book. Marsh was sitting in his parlour, reading a book by Mr. Dickens about his travels on the river and through America, when his housekeeper brought in the letter to him. He grunted with surprise and slammed down the Dickens book, muttering under his breath,
"Goddamn fool of a Britisher! Like to chuck him in the goddamn river!"
He took the letter and ripped it open, letting the envelope flutter to the floor. Getting a letter was pretty rare by itself, but this one was queerer still. It had been addressed to Fever River Packets in St. Louis and forwarded on up to Galena. Abner Marsh unfolded the crisp, yellowing paper and suddenly sucked in his breath. It was old stationery, and he remembered it well. He'd had it printed up some 13 years before to put in the desk drawer of every stateroom on his steamer. Across the top was a fancy pen-and-ink drawing of a great side-wheel steamer and Fever Dream in curved, ornate letters. He knew the hand, too, that graceful, flowing hand. The message was short. "Dear Abner, I have made my choice. If you are well and willing, meet me in New Orleans as soon as possible. You will find me at the Green Tree on Gallatin Street. Joshua."
"God damn it to hell," Marsh swore. "After all this time, does that damned fool think he can just send me some goddamned letter and make me come all the goddamned way down to New Orleans? And with never a word of explanation, neither? Who the hell does he think he is?"
"I'm sure I don't know," his housekeeper said. Abner Marsh pulled himself to his feet.
"Woman, where the hell did you go and put my white coat?" he roared.